This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. Leslie Stahl of 60 Minutes is a renowned journalist, but there's one thing I'll bet she's no better at than you are: debating climate change. It came up during her latest interview with President Trump.
I wish you could go to Greenland, watch these huge chunks of ice just falling into the ocean, raising the sea levels.
And you don't know whether or not that would have happened with or without man. You don't know.
Well, your scientists at NOAA and NASA.
No, we have scientists that disagree with that.
You know, I was thinking, what if he said, no, I've seen the hurricane situations, I've changed my mind. There really is climate change. And I thought, wow, what an impact. What an impact that would make.
I'm not denying climate change, but it could very well go back. You know, we're talking about over millions of years. They say that we had hurricanes that were far worse than what we just had with Michael.
Who says that? They say.
I mean, the people say. People say that in the.
Yeah, but what about the scientists who say it's worse than ever?
Clearly, climate change is tough to discuss, despite overwhelming scientific evidence of its existence. Or maybe because of that evidence. I mean, think about it. If someone tried to hit you over the head with a bunch of facts and figures, supremely confident that they are right and you are wrong, how would you feel? Or if someone flat out refused to hear you out, despite the facts being really clear, and just dug in their heels to avoid feeling like they lost an argument, what would that be like? We want to elevate this debate, to change the way we talk about climate change. And we want to hear from you. Where do you stand on the issue? And what has it been like discussing it with people whose views are different from yours? What's worked? And what has not? Email us, 1A@WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. Joining us from KUOW Public Radio in Seattle is Sarah Myrie, a research associate at the University of Washington. She holds a PhD in ecology from UC Davis. She also founded the Rowan Institute, a group that empowers leaders to tackle climate change. Sarah, welcome to 1A.
Thanks for having me.
Joining us from NPR in New York is Paul Bledsoe, a lecturer at American University's Center for Environmental Policy. American owns WAMU, the station that produces 1A. He's also a former climate advisor to the Clinton White House and a strategic advisor at the Progressive Policy Institute. Paul, welcome.
Thanks, Joshua.
Sarah, I wonder if we should just frame the discussion very clearly. First of all, this is a conversation that's for skeptics and believers alike, right? This is bigger than just, is climate change real? This kind of feels to me like the human aspect of working our way through this issue, right?
Yeah, definitely. This is something that impacts all of the political decision-making aspects of our public life right now, how we're integrating science and how we're essentially distorting science across this partisan divide that is really characterizing this political moment in our nation right now.
Now, we heard from President Trump in that 60 Minutes interview momentarily, just a few minutes ago. On that note, John left us this note in our inbox.
My question really is, why does the president insist on denying that climate change is a fact and that global warming is something that we have to contend with as a nation and would require, you know, a Manhattan Project or an Apollo program level of effort to try to stem what's coming in the next 12 years if we do nothing? So that's my question. And who's advising him on climate science, and why is he being so adamantly ignorant about the problem?
John, thanks for contacting us through our app, 1A Vox Pop. Paul, what is your sense of who is advising the president?
Unfortunately, Donald Trump is driven by near-term political calculus, not by the long-term welfare of the American people when it comes to this issue. I think he's tried to create a cultural divide on it, and that means that we who talk about climate change have to talk about it differently. We can't make it a technocratic or scientific issue. What we need to do is talk about the danger to public safety, the threat to national security, and the huge economic costs. Those are themes that will meet all Americans where they live at their dining room tables. That's the kind of rhetoric we need all politicians, but especially those who are active on climate change, to talk about. Instead of lecturing people about the science of the problem, We need to talk about the impacts here and now, how to prevent them, and how to prevent our people from undergoing the harm they already are.
Yeah, we've heard from some of you about how climate change is already beginning to impact you. John tweeted, "Former skeptic here, not sure when I turned the corner. Maybe when I started having basement issues here in the Midwest due to the huge rainfalls we get these days. As a kid, we never got 4 to 9 inches of rain in a 24-hour period. All skeptics will eventually see it for themselves." Sarah, I wonder if you could just chime in on part of what we heard from John. He referred to people who are, in his words, adamantly ignorant about the problem. Is that fair? Is it fair to assume that people who are climate change skeptics are, in John's words, adamantly ignorant?
Well, I wouldn't characterize folks like that. Part of my job as a scientist is to be able to speak to people with empathy and with dignity. And the people that are on the fence, you know, so this public conversation has been so distorted across this partisan space because of how well-funded the interests from fossil fuel and oil companies have flooded the market of ideas with distortive narratives. And so it makes a lot of sense that people are skeptical because they're receiving a lot of messages that they should be skeptical. And as well, this value system around whether you, quote, believe or don't believe in climate change, you ask people that question right now in American politics, and what you're actually asking is, who are you? What side are you on?
Yeah.
Where do you fall? How does the line get divided? And so people are trying to respond appropriately to the environment of the discourse around them, and it's profoundly confusing.
Yeah, the politics of this is what Brian emailed us. Brian writes, "Seems to me the first step to objectively assessing any issue is to stop listening to leaders who are telling me what I want to hear. We Americans have empowered the lowest common denominator by allowing politicians to play on our emotions rather than our intelligence. A true leader is one who can lead us where we need to go as opposed to where we want to go." We are speaking to Sarah Myrie of the University of Washington and the founder of the Rowan Institute, and Paul Bledsoe, former climate advisor to the Clinton White House, a lecturer at American University, and also with the Center for Environmental Policy. Glad to hear from some more of you, including some of you who doubt some of the arguments behind climate change. Here's one listener who left a note in our inbox.
"I'm not fully convinced that climate change has been caused by people, but I'm pretty certain, and I've heard enough, that I'm 100% convinced that we are a fiduciary of our planet and have to do everything we can to affect a positive outcome. It's just like being a parent. Might not be certain our child did something wrong, but we want to do everything we can to affect a positive outcome for our generation and their future generations. Thank you."
Thank you for sharing your thoughts. Paul, I wonder if you could respond to that. I'm interested by this idea of being, as the listener put it, a fiduciary of our planet. That's come up in a number of comments from some of our listeners. Hillbilly Mystic tweeted, "Maybe reframe the issue in terms of budgeting. The Earth only has so much in terms of natural resources. If we keep overspending and draining our account, then Mother Earth will evict us. We will run out of resources and we will be bankrupt." Paul?
That notion is very powerful. In the evangelical Christian community, it's they talk about protecting God's creation and how the earth is sacred. That's true in many cultures. Another way to think about it is in budgetary terms. The U.S. Congress spent $130 billion on extreme weather events made worse by climate change last year alone. That's nearly a quarter of the non-defense discretionary budget. This is hitting taxpayers. You know, I also wanted to talk about the notion of separating different kinds of people who are denying or skeptical about climate change. There are certain people who actually know and are doing it for manipulative purposes. And those people, Exxon and other oil companies, knew about the problem in the 1980s and covered it up and denied it. And there's certain political actors who do that today. That's different from Americans who are genuinely confused about the issue and need to be informed and need to be reached culturally. where they live. And I think that's an important point. The second thing I'll say is that it's time we injected some American can-do spirit into this discussion. When John Kennedy was confronted with the space race in the Cold War, he challenged the country in 10 years to reach the moon. What disappoints me about President Trump more than anything is he's kind of a climate wimp. The problem is too hard for him. He just can't deal with it.
Well, Paul, hold on a second. Let me just push back against that. I know we have to pause in a minute, but is name calling going to help the debate for climate change, calling the president a wimp? I mean, is that helpful?
He's a defeatist. You've got to call him like you see him.
That's kind of calling it by a longer, more SAT-ish word, wimp, defeatist. I mean, is that helpful?
He's denying a problem that is threatening the safety and welfare of the American people. Sometimes we have to say it like it is, Joshua. We can't sugarcoat the truth when we come to the American people's safety, security, and economic future.
Sarah, I know we got to pause in a minute, but is Paul right? Am I being a little bit too forgiving in terms of the way we talk about the president?
I mean, my view is that we need to indict public leaders who are trafficking in science denial as a form of misconduct and a form of putting the American public into danger. However, I do think that we as scientists have engaged nonstop in trying to confront denialism, and often that engagement is it's coded male power brokering that is very problematic in the culture because it pits people against each other instead of focusing on shared values.
Well, I do want to focus on some of more of our shared values and how we talk about climate change as we continue with Sarah Myrie of the Rowan Institute and Paul Bledsoe of American University's Center for Environmental Policy. We also heard from some of you who have seen the damage from Hurricane Michael and how that affected your view of the discussion of climate change. I'll get to that comment in just a moment. I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR.
I want to see this world. I want to see it boil. It's only 4 degrees, it's only 4 degrees.
This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We're discussing climate change and what we discuss when we discuss climate change with Sarah Myrie, founder of the Rowan Institute, and Paul Bledsoe, a professorial lecturer at American University's Center for Environmental Policy. We'd love to hear from you, too. Wherever you are on the spectrum of belief with regards to climate change, what kind of conversations are you having with people in your life about climate change? Have you been able to win anyone over? Have you had any arguments that just went sideways? Tell us what this conversation's been like for you. Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@WAMU.org. We know that for quite a few of you, discussing climate change can be difficult. Some of you have been giving us your suggestions for what has worked for you or what might work. Melissa writes, "For my Bible friends, I remind them that we are called to be good stewards of the earth. Nothing the environmentalists are suggesting would cause harm. For my fiscally conservative friends, I talk about the economics. Green power is more profitable and is the future economy. More jobs, better jobs. Saving the earth for their grandchildren is way down on the list." We also heard from some of you who are dealing with the difficulties of discussing climate change. Caitlin left this note in our inbox.
I recently graduated with my bachelor's in environmental science, and I'm very interested in protecting the environment and teaching others about climate change. I want to know ways in which I can better explain myself to others, just regular people who might not have the education that I have about climate change. Because from where I'm standing, it's blatantly obvious what's going on. And it just seems like we really need to come together and actually make a change, or there's going to be a really bad end.
Caitlin, thanks very much for sharing your thoughts with us. Paul, I wonder how you would respond to Caitlin, particularly because I think sometimes, if I may just add to her comment, the terminology often gets us in trouble. I mean, some people use the phrase climate change. Some people say extreme weather. Some people say global warming. And just beginning to get on the same page can be one of the core problems of talking about all this.
It's a great point. We need to recognize that the good news is we have the solutions to address this problem. The technical solutions, the energy solutions, the policy solutions. What we lack are political will and consensus around action. We know that we have to peak global emissions by 2020 and go to zero net carbon by 2050. Turns out we have the technologies, renewables, carbon capture, electric vehicles, and many others to make that happen if we make a real push. But it is going to take a huge push like we made during the Cold War. I wish the country would come together over this expression of American leadership leading the world again to safety. I think that's possible. But when one party in the United States denies factual information over a 20-year period, then elects a president who almost campaigned on it, it becomes very difficult to engage with that. And I think voters may reflect that in this midterm election.
George tweeted, as an environmental health scientist, I focus on telling people about the immediate and local clean air health benefits that will go to people in locations taking action to address climate change pollution and reducing fossil fuel burning, irrespective of opinions on climate. Katie emailed, my family has vacationed in Mexico Beach in Florida for 20 plus years, and we have many friends and loved ones from Panama City who have lost everything, meaning in Hurricane Michael. My father is a disbeliever of climate change and has been very upset about losing a place we love so much. He won't consider that just maybe there is a greater thing at play here. What is it going to take for this to change? How do we, those who are convinced it is happening, change the way we talk about it, and rather than shutting down the conversation, nurture it? Sarah, how would you respond to Katie?
Gosh, that's a really, really great question. And I can feel the pain that she's in and the loss that her family is struggling with to describe. And, you know, this is the piece around recognizing how difficult this information is. Like, I got exposed to the science of climate change when I started graduate school, and it took me like 6 years to integrate the scale of difficulty of that information. And it people can get exposed to the science of climate change, and they can be in such a vulnerable place that it's actually potentially dangerous for students and people who are struggling with mental health issues. So the way that we unpack this, I think, is through relationship and trust and empathy, because as we interact as individuals and we come to terms with the scale of the change and the crisis, you can have a lot of really basal emotions and fear, anger, anxiety, all of these pieces that we all shunt away from those very challenging emotions. And often when we feel those emotions, we shunt into our partisan corners where we think we know the way the world is, and we become ever more entrenched in our existing worldview. And that's why being honest that, yeah, this is a really difficult conversation, and that's exactly why we're having this conversation, is one of the ways to start.
Sarah, if I could just dig in a little deeper on that, I wonder mm-hmm. if this idea of being empathetic and being a little compassionate might also speak to the conversations with folks who feel very fatalistic. I mean, it's hard not to read the latest report from the UN's climate change panel, which we discussed last week on this program, yeah. and not feel like, well, we're all going to die anyway. Why bother? Run up your credit, because they're not going to be around to collect. You know what I'm saying? Like, it just feels like an intractable problem. And I wonder if maybe a little empathy for folks who feel that way would go a long way.
Well, I get it. And I want to remind us that as we sit with the privilege of Western lifestyles, and we look at this science that we've invested public money into, you know, remembering that we're living a science fiction fantasy right now. And we can look to human history and see that there are many other cultures around us, and specifically in the U.S., Native American and indigenous Native American people, who have already experienced the kind of cultural eradication that we are looking at down the line. The consequences from climate change, we can look at the stories of human tenacity and how people struggle and survive through massive, massive shifts. We know these stories, and we can inform our strength and our resilience and our courage by looking at the stories of, for example, the water protectors and the people who are standing at the front lines right now saying, the earth is precious, we only have one planet, and we are all going to show up and inform the public's eye of the necessity of staying in this place and staying vigilant.
Joshua, so I would just go ahead. Please.
Go ahead, Paul. Go ahead.
Oh, I would just add that fatalism is a reasonable reaction if you don't know the full range of solutions. There's a lot of good news here. 2 years ago, we eliminated one of the six main greenhouse gases. It will no longer exist on Earth 20 years from now with the Kigali Agreement to phase out HFCs. Turns out there are three or four other super pollutants like methane and black carbon. If we can reduce these quickly, about three times the current rate, we can limit near-term warming and prevent runaway climate change. We need education about the fact that we can take hold of the climate crisis and actually solve it, to combat that fatalism, which is a serious problem. And I really do feel empathy for people who are overwhelmed by it.
And Paul, just to dig into that a little further, what are HFCs?
HFCs are hydrofluorocarbons, or man-made gas that ironically are used in refrigeration, in air conditioners. And they're growing incredibly quickly because we phased out an earlier set of CFCs, chlorofluorocarbons, to fix the ozone hole. By the way, it's worth noting that that happened under Ronald Reagan, a Republican. It's also noting that the acid rain problem was solved under George H.W. Bush, a Republican. Republicans have historically taken very responsible positions on environmental problems, but they've gone off the rails lately, and we need to help them back.
I did not realize that HFC, these are some of the refrigerant chemicals that kind of siphon the heat out of a refrigerator and help it vent out so the
exactly
refrigerator
right.
stays cold.
And they're 3,000 times more powerful per molecule than CO2. Incredibly powerful chemicals. And if we keep using them, if we had kept using them, we would have raised temperatures more than a degree Fahrenheit by 2050. Now that we're phasing it out, we're preventing that warming. We can do this.
Let's talk about that 1 degree, 2 degree, 3 degrees thing, Sarah, because that also came up with a number of comments we've gotten. And the number of degrees that the Earth's average temperature increases is a key part of the latest report from the UN. Ron emailed, "I'd like to hear the scientists talk more about the likelihood of the world reaching higher temperatures than 2 degrees centigrade. For example, I've heard that if we reach 2 degrees centigrade, then the likelihood of reaching 3 or 4 degrees or higher becomes greater and greater. What would the world look like? Not at 2 degrees centigrade, but at 3, 4, 5, or 6 degrees hotter." Sarah, give us a sense of where you think that kind of a specific data point should sit in our everyday conversations about climate change. Do we need to be talking about degrees centigrade, or is there a better way about it?
Well, the global community has used these metrics to describe the limits to warming as a way to make decisions. But we can deconstruct that 1 degree C or 1.5 or 2 degree C and remember that this isn't just about warming. This is about changing the biological, chemical, and physical composition and nature of the planet forever. So we're talking about where... what kind of storms, the intensity of storms, what kind of seasonality, how the kinds of environments shift towards the poles, how mountain ice and sea ice decrease, how ocean circulation changes, how fisheries and ocean productivity changes. So we have these metrics for temperature change and for our future trajectories. But those inside of those trajectories are encompassed vast complexities of reorganization and consequences. And some places will warm more and some places will warm less. So it's a global average. And so in some ways, it's very meaningful, but it doesn't really discreetly describe like what will happen here in the Pacific Northwest.
And I agree with Sarah. I would just add that there's a new study out of the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences that finds that a destabilization of the climate may be imminent. That runaway, uncontrollable, cascading climate change could happen if we pass 2 degrees Celsius. So this is not a linear problem. This is a problem where warming begets warming, that melting of ice then absorbs heat in the oceans rather than reflecting it back out of the atmosphere, and dozens of other self-reinforcing feedbacks. That's why time is short. We need to act.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Ashley emailed, I've heard that before the last ice age, there was a warming period. Is there a chance that this is part of a long-range cycle? Could you give me science, lack thereof? I definitely believe in taking care of our planet, but the left is pushing me away daily. Climate change has become so left versus right. Matt tweeted, I don't buy that climate change deniers actually disbelieve the science. It seems to me that what most people who deny climate change have trouble with is the fact that to combat it, we're going to have to radically change the way we live. I wonder if, you know, maybe, I know our time discussing this is short, but I wonder if maybe part of the solution to improving the way we talk about climate change is to do less talking. I'm not a climate change expert, but I do have conversations for a living, and I found that the best way to get someone to converse with me is to be the first one to listen. And I get the sense that a lot of people who are still on the fence just feel they can't have the discussion because they're about to be pilloried with information about the latest report from the National Academy of Sciences. And that report is valuable, but I wonder if maybe we just need to listen to one another more, especially people who are skeptical, just to let them know that it's a safe space and a safe time to have a conversation. Sarah, is that too touchy-feely, or is there something to that?
I don't think that's too touchy-feely. I mean, you can talk about the science until you're blue in the face, right? But then when we are actually trying to sit in relationship with people, that's a two-way street. That is an experience where you have to listen in order to engender trust and relationship. And, you know, part of the piece around this is that realizing as scientists, we're trying to broker power and authority in the public. We're trying to gain agency and authority in order for the science that we are stewarding to be integrated into public decision making. But that piece around brokering for power, man, that you got to get curious about that, right? Because there's all sorts of lines that divide our culture around, you know, who is trusted, who gets buy-in, who has authority. And that's why as a feminist, as a public feminist, I use a feminist lens to think about how scientific information is brokered in the public and how I, as a woman scientist, I'm constantly reframed as unqualified to broker information in the public. And so if we want to talk about integrating science into public policy and developing trust, we really want to get more and more curious about why are voices being eliminated from the public forum? Why do we have such a partisan distortive narrative?
But it is worth pointing out that this is a U.S. phenomenon.
Sure.
The partisanization of climate change is not a global phenomenon. It doesn't exist in most of the world. And we need to reflect on the U.S. political and cultural system right now and our norms and do some honest thinking about, are we being manipulated by people who have self-interest that aren't matching up with the long-term self-interest of the American people, which is what many of us believe is happening? This is a U.S. problem almost uniquely in its political and cultural aspects.
I would agree with that, but I just want to reflect back again that the entire world, by and large, and the world's global resources are run by men, and those decisions are made by men. And so one of the fundamental aspects of solutions for climate change has to do with anti-racism and anti-misogyny, and that is at a global level, is that the closer we get to an equitable and safe society for everyone, specifically for the rights of girls and women, then that's a component of the pathway for us to get towards those climate solutions.
There's a little more with this that I'd like to discuss. I know we have to pause. We'll finish this up on the other side of the break. I'd like us to kind of do a little bit of role-playing of what you can say to folks in certain kinds of debates, to some of the more common objections, including like just that being Earth cycles or where does the science come from. We also got a good question from Arlene, who wrote on our website, the1a.org. So if you change people's minds, what then? I see a lot of people who believe in climate change that do nothing to try to mitigate it in their own personal lives. They're still driving around in gas-guzzling SUVs, owning their own McMansion houses with the thermostat turned up, not recycling, not cutting back on meat and dairy, basically waiting for someone else to do something. It's like it's someone else's tomorrow, not ours. interesting point, Arlene. Even if you win the argument, what do you do to turn the argument into action? And if you haven't done that, does that mean your argument failed? That's ahead. Stay close. Before we get back to our conversation, we would love your help with tomorrow's program about being Native American. Massachusetts Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren recently announced that a DNA test has confirmed what she's said all along, that she is indeed of tribal heritage. The test was a clapback to President Trump, who mocked her for claiming that heritage and referred to her as Pocahontas. Critics, including some tribal leaders, say direct ancestry matters more than DNA testing in this regard. It's just one of many issues that may have Native American voters talking ahead of the midterms. If you are Native American, what has claiming your heritage meant to you? What tribe are you part of? And how does that factor into your life? Leave us a voicemail, 855-236-1A1A. Now, if you're not Native American, then share what your heritage means to you, especially if it's something you learned about a little later in life. What did you discover, and how did it change you? Tell us your story. 855-236-1A1A. Or you can leave us a radio-quality audio file through our app, 1A Vox Pop. We'll share some of your stories tomorrow on 1A. Back now to our conversation with Sarah Myrie and Paul Bledsoe. Let's get in a few more of your questions and comments before we move on. Noelle tweeted, I'll teach clients to think of anxiety kind of like sugar. A little gives you energy to get going, and too much shuts you down and drains you. Need to keep it at that middle area, I guess. Let's get back to Arlene's question on our website. And Paul, I wonder if you could respond to her. Arlene writes, so if you change people's minds, what then? I see a lot of people who believe in climate change that do nothing to try to mitigate it in their own personal lives. They're still driving around in gas-guzzling SUVs, owning their McMansion houses with the thermostat turned up, not recycling, not cutting back on meat and dairy, basically waiting for someone else to do something. It's like someone else's tomorrow, not ours.
No doubt. Personal action is important, not least so that you're not hypocritical when you advocate policy and political action. But let's be clear that it will take large policy action to reduce emissions in the United States and globally, to make the United States once again a global leader in cutting emissions to solve this problem. We have to, the biggest thing you can do personally for climate change action is to vote out people who won't take it and vote in people who will. And I don't mean just Democrat and Republican, because within those parties, there are a few Republicans who acknowledge, like the congressman from South Florida, but there are many more who deny it. On Democratic side, there are some who are not strong enough and do not advocate serious policies. We have to recognize this is an imminent threat to people's public safety, national security, and economic well-being, as all the recent hurricanes, wildfires have shown. We need to vote.
I think one of the kind of saving graces, Sarah, at this point in the conversation is that we do need to deal with those policy issues, but just being able to have the conversation in a useful, successful way, I think that's a form of progress as well. You just get people kind of pointed in the direction of being willing to do something. So by way of kind of wrapping up, I want to go through a few common objections to the basic argument around climate change and sort of role play how one might respond to those. For example, B tweeted, I often run into these excuses. If warming is happening, why do we still have winter? And we've been told for decades that bad things would happen years ago, but they haven't. Sarah, how would you respond to that?
Well, I mean, bad things are happening right now. So there's evidence that those projections are coming true. I mean, all of the pieces of projections that we have seen around temperature and carbon concentrations, I mean, we are able to do a very good job at projecting the impacts of climate change on the ground. And that's the state of the science right now. It's phenomenal.
And I guess the issue is not just that we're having winter, but we're having like day after tomorrow winter. Like we're having super winter.
Right. And so like Yes, and there's complexity in how the regional climates and the seasonality of different places are influenced by the Arctic weather system basically collapsing and how that changes North American climate. And so we do see these complexities, and this is why people get confused, right? Because they're like, well, wait a second, this was a massive storm, but this is the fundamental distinction between weather and climate. Climate, we can measure climate for the last, you know, million years, right? And the climate of Earth's planet has been the oscillations between glacial and interglacial states, abrupt warming into interglacials, followed by slow cooling into glacial states. So that pacing of glacial-interglacial warming, that cold-to-warm structure, that was fundamentally paced by the changing geometric relationship between the Earth and the Sun.
Sarah, back up. You just lost me in the changing geometric relationship between glacial and interglacial states. Yeah, you just lost me.
It's so cool. It's amazing.
It's like cool, but it's confusing. Like, bring that down to Earth for me.
Okay, so in the last million years, the planet's climate has been moving between glacial states, where there's ice on top of North American and Eurasian continent, sea level is lower, it's a colder climate, and then in interglacial states. So we are in an interglacial right now.
Okay.
And that change, that cold to warm shift, this pacing, this oscillation, it's like a heartbeat of Earth's climate. And that heartbeat from cold to warm, cold to warm, that heartbeat was paced by the wiggles and wobbles of the geometric in Earth's orbit and Earth's tilt as it moves around the sun.
So I want to make sure I'm following you. This heartbeat, this Earth's heartbeat between going from cold to warm, cold to warm. It's almost like the Earth is having cardiac arrest. The heartbeat is off and the pattern is not what it's been for a million years, and we can trace it to us. Is that kind of what you're saying?
That's exactly right.
That makes perfect sense.
Pattern that's been happening for the last million years, we have fundamentally disturbed that pattern.
Gotcha. We're on a super high cholesterol, sugar, fossil fuel diet that has gotten our blood pressure through the roof. And the climate system can't take that forever. Will go out of control.
That's a perfect image. That makes perfect sense. One more thing I wanted to get to, Paul, and I know we got to let you go shortly, but for folks who question the provenance of the science, who the scientists are, that came up during the 60 Minutes interview, who say, I just don't trust the people where this data is coming from. How do I know that they don't have a political agenda? What would you say to someone with that concern to try to work through that?
I understand that you can distrust individual scientists, but there's not a conspiracy of tens and hundreds of thousands of scientists around the world to create a problem. Actually, I find it quite the opposite. In many cases, they're understating the nature of the problem because they don't want to seem alarmist. The truth is that the problem is here, now, and imminent, and that's just the factual information on the ground. We have already warmed a degree and a half Fahrenheit. We're on our way to well past 3 or even 4 Fahrenheit, and it could spin out of control. And that's just the factual information. I think very few people actually deny, about 10%, 15% of the U.S. public actually deny climate science. What I think we have to do is galvanize the 75, 80% who broadly accept it into action.
Paul Bledsoe, former climate advisor for the Clinton White House, professorial lecturer at American University Center for Environmental Policy, and a strategic advisor at the Progressive Policy Institute. Paul, thanks very much for talking to us.
Thank you, Joshua.
And Sarah Myrie, PhD, a research associate at the University of Washington and founder of the Rowan Institute. Sarah, thank you.
You're so welcome.